government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Federalist Society Free Lunch Podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. In this Free Lunch Podcast, we examine why Facebook and other big tech firms are not getting many likes these days over their user privacy and data security practices. We're going to hear from some of RTP's Cyber and Privacy Working Group experts about what the Cambridge Analytica kerfuffle was all about. We'll consider its economic, legal, and political ramifications, and we'll explore what the fallout could mean for companies that have built business models around the use of user data. Because we have a lot on the agenda and we want to get to listener questions by the end of this, I want to very quickly introduce our speakers today and hand the mic over to our moderator. If you want to know more about any of our distinguished guests, and there's plenty more to know about them, just visit regproject.org, where you can find full biographies and links to their work. Our discussion moderator today is RTP's Cyber and Privacy Working Group Chair, Matthew R.A. Hyman. Matthew currently serves as a visiting fellow at the National Security Institute at Scalia Law. Most recently, Matthew was the Vice President, Corporate Secretary, and Associate General Counsel at Johnson Controls. Matthew has also been a lawyer with the National Security Division at the U.S. Department of Justice, a legal advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, Iraq, and a trial lawyer with McGuire Woods. Matthew is joined by former FCC Chief Economist Dr. Thomas Hazlett, who is the H.H. McCauley Endowed Chair in Economics at Clemson University, as well as founder of Scalia Law's National Security Institute and adjunct professor of law, Jamil Jaffer, and also non-resident senior fellow with the Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security and the founder of Silicon Harbor Consultants, Megan Stiefel. In just a minute, I'll turn the floor over to Matthew, but before I do, I want to remind everyone that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch Podcasts are those of our featured speakers. Also, our speakers will take questions after their remarks, so please be prepared if you're going to have any questions at the start of our Q&A period. Matthew, Tom, Jamil, and Megan, thank you all for joining us today on our Free Lunch Podcast. Matthew, you have the floor now, sir.
Thank you, Devin, and thanks for the kind introductions to everyone. I'd like to start with setting the stage and explaining some of the background and how we've gotten to where we are today with regard to Cambridge Analytica and Facebook. So, Jamil Jaffer, could you summarize what the issue is and what the source of the controversy is?
Sure. So, you know, the whole thing began when newspapers broke a story about this political consulting firm, Cambridge Analytica, having potentially obtained access to a tremendous amount of user information on Facebook. The methodology by which Cambridge Analytica came across this information was that there was a researcher named Alexander Kogan at Cambridge University who had been working on a project with their psychometrics center to identify trends on Facebook and information about how users behave and how they interact with one another and the like. So Mr. Kogan, having worked on this effort, had an agreement with Facebook where he had developed an app. This is in about 2014, had developed an app that would be put on Facebook and that he would send to people, and that if they decided they want to take his quiz, could provide some voluntary information about themselves so that they could do this survey. So about 270,000 people, 270,000 people roughly, took this survey. What's interesting, though, and where this got complicated and problematic is that as part of that app, as a general part of Facebook's interaction with researchers and other app creators at the time, probably they've now changed, but at the time, was that not only could you have access to the data of those people who consented to you having access to the data, that's the 270,000 people who said, yes, I want to answer the survey, and yes, you can look at some of my information about my friends and my likes and the like, was that in the app API, the application processing interface, allowed for folks to go further, people had access to this data, and not only look at the friends of the people who gave consent, but to look at the data of those friends also, at least one degree out, maybe a couple of degrees out. What that resulted in was with these 270,000 people having taken the survey, Alexander Kogan and his team were able to access the data, the friends of friends, the likes of up to anywhere between 50 to 87 million Facebook users. So tremendous number of Facebook users. It's sort of in a lot of ways, if you think about the conversations about the U.S. government's metadata program back in the day, about sort of one hop out and how many friends you have, and then if you go two hops out, how many friends you have. It's that sort of exponential expansion of access to data. But then the data that was available was really potentially concerning to people too. We're not talking about passwords here, but we're talking about information about the way that people behave, their likes and their friends on Facebook. So this broke a few months back, raised all sorts of privacy concerns for Facebook and for the use of this data by a political consulting firm, Cambridge Analytica, that apparently had ties to the Trump campaign. And so this raised all sorts of concerns. There were congressional hearings, all sorts of controversy. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, was up on Capitol Hill testifying and the like. Raised issues in Europe also. So people quite a buzz about this concern, and Facebook under a lot of pressure agreed to change its policies, had already terminated its agreement with Cambridge Analytica, changed its policies with respect to apps, already changed those policies. That by the time the story came out, they were no longer allowing this type of access, but the fact they had done it in the past and had not told anybody about it was a concern. There's a debate about whether this was a breach at Facebook. Some people had conveyed as a breach. Facebook said, well, this wasn't actually a breach. This was a permitted use of our system, which, of course, did not make anybody feel that much better. What they meant by that was we allowed the researchers to have access. It wasn't supposed to be sold beyond that. It wasn't supposed to be given to anybody else beyond that. They violated our terms of service. But then there was a question, why didn't you do anything about it? Why didn't you get the data deleted? They said they had, but that apparently the data had not been deleted at this point now. Cambridge Analytica says it has deleted after denying for a while that they even had the data at all. So a lot of controversy, a lot of confusion about what was going on exactly, a lot of questions about whether Facebook did the right thing, whether Cambridge Analytica did the right thing, whether Alexander Kogan did the right thing, and a lot of debates in both the political and the policy sphere about what should we do about it now that we know. That's where things sort of stood until earlier this week when it came out that Facebook had similar agreements in place with device manufacturers, cell phone manufacturers. Now, it was public knowledge and has been public knowledge for a long time that Facebook has had relations with these manufacturers. They announced these relationships publicly. They were on their website. But where it got controversial was that this same type of access, this app-based access, was given to hardware manufacturers who manufactured apps and put stuff on Facebook to create interactivity between their device and the Facebook website back in the day before there was a Facebook app on smartphones. And then once there was a Facebook app on smartphones between their sort of their internal apps on their device, as well as the Facebook app, the Facebook data on the web. And what happened there was these hardware providers had the same type of access, having been app builders, that Mr. Kogan and ultimately Cambridge Analytica did, raising the same privacy concerns and the like, and even more so where these apps were actually sort of resident on the device. So, for example, back in the old days, before there was a Facebook app for BlackBerry, BlackBerry created its own app, or even when there was a Facebook app, it pulled all the app from all the other social messaging platforms into what they called the BlackBerry Hub. Now, the challenge there is, of course, that data then was being hosted in part not just by Facebook, the Facebook app on the user's phone, but potentially sometimes like companies like BlackBerry, which centralize a lot of their data services, at their data storage facilities also. And so that raised a concern in particular because of Facebook's agreements, which were public at the time, with Chinese manufacturers, in particular companies like Huawei and ZTE, which have been pilloried by the U.S. government for being close to the Chinese government, potentially sharing data, engaging in intellectual property theft, and potentially sources of intelligence relations with the Chinese government. So this has now, in the last few days, led to some more significant controversy about the Facebook apps. The problems are very similar, and the type of data we're talking about is similar, although a little different in the case of the manufacturers because the data is actually stored on the devices. But again, controversies about how Facebook's privacy profiles work, how the data of users is potentially being shared with the third parties without the user's consent or without the user's knowledge, or even if the users were aware, without the user being able to control it. Now, Facebook has sought to take action to defend against the allegations, but also to take steps to enhance user privacy, to give users a lot more control over the data they share with Facebook and how it's shared with other people, a lot more visibility into that, how it's done and how to control it. So, you know, an ongoing conversation with the government and Facebook and private industry and the public about what data they have, how they're using it with third parties, and what control users have of their own data. So let me pause there and hand it back to you, Matthew, to see if you have any questions on that or if you want to follow up with other folks.
Thank you, Jamil. I mean, I think that's a helpful grounding for kind of where we are today. I would like to turn to Megan, because while Facebook is in the news today prominently because of these privacy issues and whether or not user data was misused, or whether users fully understood the terms of service that they upon which they gave away their data, this isn't Facebook's first run-in when it comes to managing user data. They had been under an FTC consent decree. And I was wondering, Megan, could you give us a little bit of the background as to what some of Facebook's history has been with the FTC, and then perhaps what the FTC might be thinking about in connection with the current controversy?
Sure. Thanks again for organizing this. So I think most of our listeners probably are aware that the Section 5 of the FTC's governing law, which is aptly named the Federal Trade Commission Act, permits consumers to file complaints with the commission if they believe a company is engaged in unfair or deceptive trade practices. So in late 2009, an organization called the Electronic Privacy Information Center filed suit along with a group of public interest organizations, essentially alleging that changes in Facebook's policies and practices threatened user privacy. And I'll get into the, sort of what those what those allegations were. About 2 years later, then in late 2011, the FTC released a formal complaint and a proposed consent decree with Facebook. Then about 9 months later, in August of 2012, the FTC finally approved the consent decree with the company. So in its 2009 complaint, the FTC listed a number of instances in which Facebook allegedly made promises that it did not keep. The foremost one of them was that, so we all are familiar with the terms of use that unfortunately many users kind of click through and just want to get to where they want to go. In this case, the Facebook had changed its website so that certain information that users had designated as private, such as their friends list, was made public. And the complaint list alleged that Facebook had failed to warn users that this change was coming or get their approval in advance. They also had represented that third-party apps that users had installed would have access only to user information that they needed to operate, when in fact the apps could access nearly all of the user's personal data, which was kind of exceeded the scope of what the app needed to operate. Facebook had told users that they would restrict sharing of data to limited audiences, for example, friends only, when in fact selecting friends only didn't prevent the information from being shared with third-party applications. This should all be sounding familiar. It sounds a little bit like what Jamil was articulating in connection with the Cambridge Analytica issues. I won't go through all of these, but one important one that comes back is that Facebook had claimed that it complied with the US-EU Safe Harbor Framework that governs data transfers between the US and the European Union, when in fact it didn't. So the proposed settlement that Facebook, that the FTC published then in 2011, barred Facebook from making any further deceptive privacy claims and required the company to get consumers' approval before it changed the way it shares data. It also required Facebook to obtain periodic assessments of its privacy practices by independent third-party auditors for the next 20 years. So the ultimate consent decree that was approved then in 2012, again, articulated a number of the things that the complaint alleged and concluded that, among other things, Facebook was required within 180 days and every 2 years thereafter for the next 20 years, which was the term of the consent decree, to obtain independent third-party audits certifying that it had a privacy program in place that met or exceeded the requirements of the FTC's order, and to ensure that the privacy of consumers' information was protected. And the consent decree also would require, or did require, Facebook to maintain record keeping and enable the FTC to monitor compliance with its order. So it appears, based on the trail that I was able to uncover, that this part of the auditing requirements and reporting that Facebook was required to do under the consent decree was first filed in 2013, but then thereafter the trail goes dead. And so one of the questions becomes, as we've been, Jamil somewhat alluded to, is Facebook was under these ongoing obligations pursuant to the consent decree. Did they fulfill their obligations? I think the concern that some have issued is that it does not appear, based on the Cambridge Analytica information that's been made public, as well as with respect to Mark Zuckerberg's testimony, where he appeared to not have much insight into whether the details of the FTC consent decree. It's not clear that Facebook continued to pursue these third-party audits, and it's also not clear, however, whether the FTC enforced the consent decree that was out there and ever asked Facebook to provide the records that they were under an obligation to maintain and make available upon the FTC's request. So as Jamil outlined in the beginning, Cambridge Analytica occurs, and there is, as Jamil said, tremendous interest both from the Hill and overseas, as well as from general consumers. And ultimately, in March of 2018, the acting director of the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection confirmed that the FTC has a non-public investigation into certain of Facebook's practices. And here I'll quote directly from the press release. These are including that companies that fail to honor their privacy promises, such as failing to comply with Privacy Shield, or that engage in unfair acts that cause substantial injury to consumers in violation of the FTC Act. Companies who have settled previous FTC actions must also comply with FTC order provisions imposing privacy and data security requirements. So what ultimately, I think there are sort of a couple of questions that come from this, whether the FTC's investigation is a new investigation or whether they are pursuing sort of Facebook for failing to comply with its existing consent decree is one question. And if it's the latter, then Facebook could be, as I think many have read, subject to large fines. And I think we'll get into next with Tom and others what the ultimate impact, economic impact of these types of decrees and the overall idea of whether this is a meaningful approach to govern the use of data in what we consider to be kind of the gig economy.
Well, thanks, Megan. And talking about that economic impact, Tom, you're the resident economist in our group and on the call today. I'm wondering if you could articulate what has been the economic impact on Facebook so far, and then from a fine perspective and market perspective, what might be the economic impact for Facebook going forward?
Thank you. So there's a whole subfield in finance that is dedicated to investigating what others might call crisis management of corporations. And there have been a number of studies on catastrophic events that look at incidents such as product recalls or plane crashes, how firms respond. And it's been evident to everyone that stock prices are, in essence, the first wave of financial crisis for firms. And one of the questions that's been investigated for some years is in terms of punishment being dealt to companies that situations happen where their customers or others are hurt. Where are the punishments coming from? Are they coming from market reactions and stock prices? Are they coming from customers fleeing in the market, or are they coming alternatively perhaps from regulations imposed? And the finding in general has been that stock price reactions, which include the expected effects of customer migrations away from companies that cause or in some sense are responsible for catastrophes, that these stock price reactions deal out much more punishment. The classic example is that the in a study in business and marketing all over the world, the Johnson & Johnson Tylenol case from 1982, where people were literally being murdered via a product sold by Johnson & Johnson, Tylenol. And there was an immediate stock price reaction that ended up being about 10 times what the regulations cost the company. That is to say, Johnson & Johnson really did have to move quickly just based upon the financial consequences of this terrible action. By the way, a murder case that's still never been solved, but and Johnson & Johnson in some sense was an innocent victim, as well as their customers. But of course, the company had a responsibility to get to the bottom as quickly as possible, and they are today taught as an exemplary, having exemplary reactions, pulling their products and trying to get back in front of, get in front to the extent possible that they could, repackaging, adopting some rules for how the products came out that later were adopted by regulators for all companies in the marketplace. Now, Facebook has been criticized since the privacy crisis, if you will, hit the news in March for not responding very quickly. And indeed, in the first few days, Facebook share prices were plummeting, and the company lost perhaps 90 billion dollars in market value, over 15% of its stock price relative to the market. Abnormal returns, specifically associated with the privacy crisis. Of course, the idea was that customers would flee if they're not protected, and their information can be so easily distributed. And for some days, the company did not seem to be responding in a positive way. Then, after some period of time, of course, the CEO, Zuckerberg, does go to testify in Congress, does well. Stock price kicks up about 4 to 5% while he's testifying in Washington in front of Congress. The company does announce some new rules, tries to explain and adjust its enforcement mechanisms. And finally, by late April, when quarterly results were announced, investors were impressed that customers did not seem to be fleeing the company. And share prices have largely rebounded. In fact, right now, the market returns, that is, Facebook prices adjusted for say, the NASDAQ index, are about where they were in mid-March. But there have been changes, and in fact, we're in some sense into a new regime with the European rules being adopted and of course announced by Facebook as one mechanism. Other kinds of reactions take place. The question is what role regulation has and what how it will fit in. There's no doubt that there are rules that will protect consumers. Some of them are contract rules, and even where customers tend to click through to get to the free product, so to speak, paid for by the data they give up, those click-through rules are important in establishing, or regulatory assignments. It's actually quite difficult now to understand how customers can get the products they want, largely funded through giving up personal data, and yet have the limits that are prescribed in either contract or regulation, and how enforcement can actually work. And we've just heard about, you know, consent decrees and previous enforcement actions against Facebook, and of course, contract terms that Facebook may not have completely complied with the rules of its own. So it's certainly a work in progress. There are market mechanisms for forcing Facebook, Google, and other companies involved with taking data in a very useful and productive way. That is to say, very valuable products are provided on the use of the data. Many customers in general, are perfectly willing to give up some data under some rules to get these products. But the actual borders, where the lines are drawn, again, either privately or publicly, that is what all companies and customers actually are grappling with. Now, we have many different models in the marketplace. Certainly, you can call it the Apple model. There's some companies that have made competitive hay over the fact that they don't use nearly as much customer data to do targeted advertising and so forth. Apple certainly came out, even though they used some of that data, has become a controversy actually just in the last few days in terms of their relationship with Facebook. They charge what we might call high prices for equipment and services, and they rely much less on the use of access to personal data to monetize their investments. We also have, of course, the different regulatory rules and the general data protection rules coming in from the European Union now, have costs and benefits. And we certainly need to give good scrutiny to those. The protections on the one side give people perhaps more visibility. On the other side, there's already concern that large companies, like indeed Facebook, are actually protected by rules that have fairly high costs, sunk fixed costs to implement, and smaller upstart competitors in the marketplace will be discriminated against by these kinds of blanket rules that come in and apply to all firms. So anyway, there's a lot to learn about where we are now, but it certainly is going to be a formative experience. And years from now, the case books will not only include Tylenol as a classic case, but certainly the Facebook reaction to the privacy breach, and the end of that story is not written yet.
No, thanks, Tom. That's a helpful perspective. And if we shift gears just slightly and we think about, so we've heard from Tom talk about the economic consequences and what's going on in the marketplace. If we were to put ourselves into the shoes of the general counsel at Facebook, or for that matter, the general counsel at any company that's heavily reliant, let's stick with Facebook just for a moment. If we're the general counsel of Facebook and we are headed off to the board meeting and we have to explain to our directors the array of risks or legal consequences the company faces as a result of what's happened, obviously there's the FTC investigation that Megan outlined, but what are some of the other things that the general counsel might be warning the directors about in terms of legal risk or consequence? I don't know, Jamil or Megan, if you've got thoughts on that.
The one that kind of quickly jumps to mind is, while Jamil outlined that this was not a breach in the sense of what we saw with Yahoo, we did still see a shareholder suit, I believe, in connection with the breach of Yahoo's network. So I can imagine that here we might see, and I think maybe there's already been one filed, a shareholder suit in connection with Facebook's handling of the Cambridge Analytica issue, as well as Matthew just mentioned, this outstanding question of whether Facebook will face fines in connection with the existing consent decree of the FTC, or possibly a new investigation and ultimately a consent decree or a combination of the two. I don't know the statute well enough to know whether the commission could fine them as well as agree to another consent decree with Facebook.
Yeah, and we've actually seen a class action lawsuit filed in early April against Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. So there's also consumer action taking place here. Unclear whether these class actions, you know, will survive the tests in the courts, but they're at least out there, creating some exposure. And then, you know, there's the larger question of whether there are any SEC or other issues that have been, you know, violated here. Facebook is a publicly traded company, and so the question whether they complied with all of their material reporting requirements, material change reporting requirements for the SEC, I think remains an open question. So there's an open space here potentially. The FTC, I think, as Megan has pointed out rightly, and Tom also has been very aggressive in the use of its authorities when it comes to unfair trade practices. That's part of where this original consent decree came out of, and so it wouldn't surprise me here if the FTC tried to take action. Of course, there is a sort of a new FTC in town, and so whether that makes a difference is also, I think, a relevant question.
And just on the point of the FTC being sort of in the driver's seat in terms of enforcement around these topics, if you were to look into your crystal ball, and this is a question for anyone, is that likely to continue in the future, or should we anticipate some sort of regulatory reform or a more aggressive regime from some other agency in terms of regulating companies, whether it's Facebook or Amazon or any company that's really dependent on this, what I'd call this data exchange model? In other words, we give you free services, whether it's email or messenger or networking services, and in exchange, you give us data. And so I'm just wondering, do you sense there's an appetite on Capitol Hill for regulatory reform? Are there other governmental agencies that could try and get into the act because this is a target-rich area? I'm just curious as to the thoughts from the panel on that.
Well, from my end, that's Jamil, there's obviously been a lot of efforts by a lot of discussion, at least in Congress, and as you point out, in the federal regulatory space, about what to do about these problems, how to deal with them, sort of the notion that the government can and should regulate in this space. I tend to be very skeptical of government regulation in this space, in part because the technology community has flourished and been highly successful and has really created a lot of wealth in America, in part because of the light touch regulatory environment we've adopted when it comes to high technology. It's also, you know, questionable whether regulation or legislation, frankly, can keep up effectively with technology and instead of empowering us to get better technology, actually makes it worse, makes it harder to innovate, makes it harder to secure our systems because people are then trying to catch up to a standard that's been set in the law and sticky or in the regulations and doesn't make for good policy ultimately because technology outpaces it. So that can be a real challenge, I think, in this space. And so I think to some other agencies are thinking about getting involved. I would caution them not to. I think the FTC has been overly aggressive in this space as it is, and has not been particularly successful, to be honest. And so I think there's a lot of reasons to be cautious in this space, both if you're a legislator or a member of Congress, or a regulator. That being said, it is important that the companies do the right thing here and demonstrate that they can be trusted. That's just to be frank, that is not currently where we are. The public does not. The public is trusting these companies as far as they're continuing to give more and more data to these companies, but the companies are more and more being seen as not being good stewards of those data. That doesn't seem to have changed people's willingness to give it to them, but it is a concern. And so I think the companies are going to want to be able to improve their ability to protect the data and demonstrate how they're using it. And there is an ongoing debate, I think it's worth mentioning, and then I'd love to hear what Megan and Tom think about this, but there is an ongoing debate about the status of this data. Is it yours? Should it be yours? Should you be able to control it? Should you be able to monetize it yourself? And if so, how can you? I think you'll see a growth of tools and capabilities which give people the ability to manage, control, and potentially even monetize their own data. Now, there's even discussions in the courts. You saw during this debate, during the Supreme Court's discussion of the question whether cell phone locational data can be obtained by law enforcement, this notion, at least among some justices, you know, that maybe information is property, and we ought to think of information and data like property. That's a sort of a interesting theory, because it takes a thing that we haven't really thought of as property, although there are potential historical antecedents for this, and recast them that way. And that's an interesting concept to think about, that as people in the privacy community and the public are talking about, well, is my data mine and can I monetize it? So there may be sort of a coming together of these trends we've been seeing, in part driven by these public debates.
Yeah, Tom, I'm wondering from your perspective, data as property is obviously the concept's being kicked around. As an economist, is that a workable framework for us going forward in terms of organizing rights and monetizing things?
Yes, in part, but the thing that people have to understand is that's not necessarily a solution to this problem. Indeed, I think many of the social media companies would argue that you, the user, do own your data, and that they make contracts with you over how it's used. And in order for you to get access to certain services that are valuable and desirable, you enter into a sharing arrangement with that company. And you still have where that relationship ends. And in what circumstances have you given them permission, and in what circumstances have you not? So just saying it's going to be property of the user, you know, that's I think it's a useful way to think about it, but it's not going to solve many of the problems we're talking about. The other thing I wanted to mention is that with regulation, of course, there's always collateral damage and imperfect rules on the one side and then enforcement on the other. This is, you know, true in markets, true in government. So we have to be very careful that the collateral damage, particularly with respect to suppressing innovation or competition, does not outweigh the benefits. In addition, here we can fairly clearly see, given what we know about market reactions, stock markets and finance, that companies will be much better disciplined in protecting their own customers. So when there is a problem, and there has been a problem that's blown up with Facebook customers, Facebook and similar companies, in fact, Google has had some of these issues doing Gmail and Google Plus over the years, they will respond fairly quickly to backlash from their customers. It does drive down their stock price when in fact customers are not coming in because they're afraid to give information. The first and most important margin, perhaps, for regulatory concern are the spillovers. People who have not come to Facebook and said, okay, you know, I'll share some of my data here and you can give me some services. And in fact, in this particular privacy crisis that Facebook is suffering, there are fundamental issues as to you know, what the rules are for people who didn't tell Facebook, go ahead and use my personal data. So that actually is useful. It's useful to understand that the firms are really much better disciplined in relationship to their own customers than they are to these spillover effects. And I think regulators want to first, right out of the chute, they want to look to see where these, where the data is coming out that has not been part of an agreement between the individual who may be said to own the data of their, you know, their own information and the social media platform.
And Megan, I'm just wondering, in terms of it begins with the individual and someone saying, I will have a Facebook account or I'll have a LinkedIn account or whatever it may be. Do you get the sense, though, that we've reached a level of maturity on the part of the user to actually understand what it is they're trading away for these services? And if the answer is no, which I suspect it may be, is there anything that these companies should be doing or individuals should be doing to better educate themselves other than investing hours of the day reading the terms of use agreements that come with these accounts?
Yeah, I think the answer is no. For two reasons. One, we know that they don't read them, but I think the question is, well, why don't they read them? And that's because of the way that the way that the terms of service are drafted. I think one thing that companies could do to help the situation is to be a little bit more explanatory in when they describe the uses to which the collected information will be put, rather than saying we may use it for API and application programmable interface enhancements. We may use it to offer you advertising, targeted advertising. And I think so being a little bit more descriptive and transparent about the uses of the information is needed. Context matters, I think. And we know from studies that consumers, while they are sort of in the absence of information or the absence of explicit information, willing to kind of give up this information in exchange for the service, when you tell them we might sell this information to a third party, and you know the third party might be somebody who they may not want to have the information, they are more inclined to not share that information. There are a couple of Pew studies around this, I think, and a couple of others. So that's one thing I think that would help. I think at that point, then you start to see where one company begins to sort of lead the way in this space, I think others will probably follow. And I think we get to, short of regulation, I think we get to a point where companies start to compete on transparency. And that may be a little bit too soft and fuzzy for some, but I think we're sort of seeing that, as Tom alluded to, in the case of Apple. We're paying at this point a lot for devices that we perceive, hopefully correctly, are slightly more restrictive in the uses of data that we generate when we use them. But we may begin to see a market effect from this idea of competing on what I sometimes think about as security and privacy. Rather than thinking of these things as cost centers, thinking of them as features in a product that we need consumers to want, particularly in the case of both cases, I would say, but particularly in the case of security, we want companies to be protecting the information and thinking about their platforms in a way that is a tool to our economic growth. And so one of the things that I think we're sort of talking around a little bit is something that is not a tangible harm that can result in a complaint with the FTC, but this notion of trust in these platforms, and we're beginning to see decreasing levels of trust. So efforts by companies to try and restore and buttress that trust, I think, through ideas such as increased transparency and context around the uses of consumer data can help continue to foster this space as an economic tool and whatnot.
In a sense, it sounds like you're almost talking about the notion of database businesses adopting kind of a Volvo business model, right? Everyone understands when they buy a Volvo, they're getting a safe car. At least that's been the Volvo mantra for years and years. And I think a lot of families paid a somewhat of a premium to have that Volvo because they felt like this was a terrifically safe and reliable vehicle, and perhaps that's a business model opportunity for some of these data companies.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent example. I mean, this is brand name competition. And when a company's stock is hit, it's a hit on the goodwill of the firm, meaning brand name capital. So that is what's happening. And in fact, after the Facebook problem, soon thereafter, Apple CEO Tim Cook gave some comments that became somewhat controversial about how, you know, Apple doesn't do this kind of a thing, which may have been a little farther than in hindsight, he might want to go on that claim. But the critics, CNBC on-air commentators in real time immediately picked up on the fact that, well, that's easy for Apple to say. They charge $1,000 for a phone. And Facebook doesn't do that. Facebook's got a different monetization model. So having said that, that is the competition. You know, this is what I think Megan's talking about. We want firms to do more, maybe opt in rather than opt out. We want firms to have a subscription model here or there instead of the freebie model. There's no perfect solutions, and there's no black or white, all one or all the other. There's going to be a mix, but the competition between the firms to find the right mix, that is what we aim to do. And you know, certainly one of the problems with automation is that it tends, for necessity, to have a one size fits all and push everybody to one end of the market or the other. And, forgetting about some of the other, nuances and enforcement issues, but that is not, that's not what we're talking about as a solution. We know that there are very beneficial platforms that have been created with the use of information that comes to the social media platforms, and people do want the benefit of that, but, again, finding the limits. That can is coming through a competitive system, and it's important to pay attention to these nuances.
I think on that point, Devin, it'd be a good time to open the lines for our audience members to see if they have any questions for the panel.
Yeah, let's do that, Matthew, and thank you everyone for your thoughts and your comments. So we're going to go to audience questions now, and second, you'll just you'll hear a prompt, and again, the floor mode's been turned on. After that, you can request the floor by entering star and then pound on your telephone keypad. Let's do that. Okay, I think the floor mode is on now. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and you can ask your question thereafter. We'll answer all the questions in the order in which they're received. We've got a couple of people queued in already, but I'd like to make an announcement before we get to that. First, I just want to plug the work of this a Regulatory Transparency Project, Cyber and Privacy Working Group. They've done amazing work over the last couple of years, and especially in the last year, in releasing a paper, Regulators in Siberia, which you can find at regproject.org, along with a number of other Teleforum podcasts that can also be found there, and some other work as well. But next week, we'll be releasing the first paper. Next week, Tuesday, June 12th, we'll be releasing the first paper in a series on some of these privacy issues that members of this working group have authored. I think, anyone who's on this call who's interested in this sort of thing is really going to enjoy that series of papers. They're somewhere in the range of 4 to 7 pages long, but I think, having the perspectives of the experts on this working group is really going to open up some conversation around these issues, and I hope that you'll be following that series. Again, first paper is coming out next week, Tuesday, June 12th, at the regproject.org website. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn if you want to get updates on that. Okay, we'll get to the first question now.
Hi, thank you for doing this call. Professor Hazlett talked a bit about, or mentioned really, the barriers that the GDPR will put in front of smaller market entrants. I'm wondering if you could talk a little more about, this is for Professor Hazlett and anybody else, talk more about those barriers to small entrants by the GDPR.
Well, not too much more, because I would profess to be an expert on the European rules or their implementation, which are, it's just a work in progress right now. But the idea in software, of course, and on all these social media platforms, is they're enormous economies of scale, and the leverage from the existing, or the initial investments for the successful platforms is remarked upon. So you sort of reverse that when you have a blanket rule about how you're going to change the software, and when the larger platforms can perform all the necessary coding and tweaking for their systems, they amortize over very large customer bases, and yet many of those costs are still fixed.
for the upstarts who do not yet enjoy the big platform. So there really are reports already out that the major platforms have been investing in whole new departments of lawyers and coders to comply with these regulations. And it's not surprising that this kind of process will tend to favor the larger firms. This is a long running theme, certainly in public choice economics, where you can see that large firms often lobby for these kinds of solutions just because they know what their financial interests are. But in terms of regulatory and public policy studies, you do see these differential cost outcomes that for conscientious regulators are a big concern. So that is a concern here. We'll see how it plays out. But that, the initial reports are that this is certainly something that we're having to deal with right now.
Thanks, Tom. Any other thoughts among the panelists?
Yeah, I'll just chime in on GDPR. This is Matthew Hyman. As Tom said, the large firms will be the ones that are best positioned to manage the costs. They have the armies of lawyers and compliance professionals that a small firm doesn't. And there's been reports out there that just to get the technical tool to deal with GDPR, so the systems needed to manage the data appropriately. Some surveys show that the average cost of that's $1 million. So for Facebook, $1 million is nothing. For a small startup, Facebook's a huge amount of money, an amount that may make it crippling in the sense of deciding whether they want to continue to serve people that are in the EU market. So it has a huge differential impact depending on the size of the firm.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Matthew. We'll go on to our next question now. I hope, caller, that was enlightening to you.
Good afternoon. I'd like to raise two factors that I think bear on the degree of Facebook's culpability, and I'd like to hear the panel's thoughts. One is that it's my understanding that Kogan violated Facebook policy by selling the data to Cambridge Analytica. And secondly, that the friends whose data was mined had given permission for their data to be accessed by apps that their friends had consented to. Could you comment on those two things, please?
Sure. I think there's certainly certainly Kogan violated the terms of use that his agreement with Facebook. And that's obviously something Facebook has pointed out is, look, this is not a breach. He was authorized to have this data. However, he was not authorized to sell it. That's him behaving inappropriately. There are questions about whether Facebook then, once they realized that Kogan might have violated their terms of use, where they took sufficient action to address that. They were in contact with them, but people have raised the concern that they didn't confirm, although it's unclear how they would have confirmed that the data was in fact deleted when they asked to have it deleted, because they did ask to have it deleted. And then whether they should have taken further action and whether they should have notified the public of the fact that the data had been used in a way that Facebook had not permitted. With respect to the second question that you asked, that the friends whose data was able to be accessed had given authorization for apps to access their data. That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that, but let's sort of play that out, right? I think that let's say you were a person who said, yes, apps can use my data. Presumably, what you're thinking there is the apps that you've authorized. Now, it may be that you're right that in the agreements that Facebook had with or the terms of service on the given apps or the like said something to the effect of, other folks that use apps, their apps can access your data. And that may even have been okay with users. The issue, though, is then third parties who have access to those apps, the app data then being given out. And so because there was no relationship between the 55 or 87 million users whose data was able to be accessed through the apps that the 270,000 people gave access to Kogan and who also gave it to Cambridge Analytica, I think the concern amongst folks is that there wasn't a lack of understanding that even if they had consented to the apps having access to the data, that such a
that those would go then to third parties to whom a friend of theirs had consented. Again, could be, very well be, that there's no violation here of their own policies because their policies are made clear and the people had in fact given the appropriate consent. The challenge, I think, is the people's perception that they were not giving the or given the opportunity to give the relevant kind of consent. And Facebook's largely admission that, yes, we could have done better here. Probably the right play, likely to stave off regulation, legislation in this space, you know, rather than sort of say, no, look, we did everything right here, and it's their problem because they didn't read the terms of use properly. But a fair point.
I'll go on to the next question now. If anyone else on the call has a question, you can enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and you can enter the queue.
Hi, I'd like to see if anybody has any thoughts on Wall Street Journal reporting over at least the last 8 weeks in their financial markets, where Zuckerberg has been selling, I think it's probably millions of shares. I'm sure it's within the SEC rules, but public opinion might differ. Thanks.
I'm happy to take that one as someone that dealt with executives selling shares at public companies. This is Matthew Hyman. I don't know the details of his stock sales, but it is not unusual for senior executives at companies to have regular, almost automated sales of their shares. So as we all know, senior executives are compensated in large measure by receiving stock and options. And the SEC allows for what are almost like pre-programmed plans for sale of stock. So a CEO is often pregnant, almost always pregnant, with certain knowledge that's non-public. And if you're trading on non-public, material non-public information, you run afoul of SEC regulations. And so the way to get around that is to have a pre-arranged, what's often called a 10b5 trading program, that basically says, I'm going to sell X amount of shares every quarter or once a year, and it's automatic and it's already pre-programmed so that nothing I'm doing at the company is impacting either to my advantage or disadvantage sale of shares. So I think the question I would have, and again, I haven't investigated the details of Zuckerberg's stock shares, but I would think that given his position, he would be selling shares under a 10b5-1 plan. I'd be surprised if he's not doing that because it's just really hard to manage it because of the very issues, you know, of being a CEO and always knowing something that your shareholders don't know. I don't know if anyone else has comments on it.
I just note that, the sales were on a prearranged plan, and they started long before the public announcement of a problem in you know, over the Cambridge Analytica fiasco in March. So, they're big numbers, but you know, Zuckerberg is you know, he's very long on Facebook stock and probably does need to diversify. And from the reports, the money has largely gone to his charitable trust for charitable purposes. So, you know, God help him if there's a connection between inside information and the sales. But this does look to be a sort of a standard insider transaction.
Thanks, fellas. Thanks for the question. We're running up at the end of our time here, so I'm going to try to get to the last two questions I see here. Caller, you're on.
What do you think about, or what can you comment about the fact that apparently they did the same thing not for pay with the Obama campaigns and knew about the app they were using and that it was accessing users' data back in 2012?
So just to be clear, I think the caller is asking about how the Obama campaign in 2012 aggregated information through, I don't know if it's identical means, but similar means to the way Cambridge Analytica might have for the Trump campaign. And so does that make any difference in our analysis of what happened because the Trump campaign paid for the work? I don't know, Jamil or Megan, if you've got a take on that.
Yeah, I mean, from my end, I mean, obviously, people seem to have gotten less worked up about the use of the data by the Obama campaign than they have about the recent sharing of the data with Cambridge Analytica and then the use of that data by the Trump campaign. Not clear why that's the case, other than in this scenario, at least, and I don't know what exactly how the Obama campaign got the information back in that era. So, but going to this scenario, the frustration has been about the fact that users didn't understand, or at least the perceptions that the users didn't understand their data was being scraped by these apps, and that more users than just the ones who were interacting with the app had their data scraped also. Now, is it really the case that the spin up ended up becoming because it had to do with Cambridge Analytica, the Trump campaign? That could be. And if it turns out that the information got in the same way in the Obama campaign and people weren't spun up about that, well, that's clearly a problem in public perception. But at the end of the day, sort of the legal and policy question is what do you do about the fact that users have this sense that whomever is using the data, ultimately Trump or Obama or somebody else or private companies or third parties like Huawei or the Chinese, what do you do about the fact that users appear to be, at least in the public space? And again, it may not be that users are actually concerned about the use of this data, but at least publicly it seems that users might be concerned because at least press reports suggest that. But of course, their behavior doesn't suggest that. But they are now concerned about the use of that data potentially. And so what do you do about that fact, putting aside who got it and how they got it and why people are spun up now and not previously? But it's an important point to raise that it is odd that nobody seems to bat an eyelash back then, and now people are very concerned. Maybe it's a change in our perceptions. Maybe it's the way that the media is covering it, or the way that the people who are concerned about these issues feel about the Obama campaign versus the Trump campaign. I don't know the answer to that question. What I can say, though, is that it appears, at least in the public space, but aside user behavior on one side, people are concerned about how data is being used by these companies and who it's being shared with.
And the regulatory issue might run right into campaign finance law. That would be the thing that jumps out on that if it's an in-kind corporate contribution. So there may be some discussion about that. There's been a little bit so far. But obviously customer reactions are going to be what customer reactions are. And it's difficult, from a distance to see exactly why it goes one way versus another.
Devin, do we have one more?
We do have one more. Let's go ahead.
Other than media assertions that the public is upset about their privacy being violated, based on the continued use of Facebook, how do we even know that in fact users are all that upset? And if they were, wouldn't we see a major changeover in their settings? And I'm not sure that could be documented at this point.
No, I mean, that's a great point. That's sort of what I was alluding to, at least from my end, Jamil, about user behavior. You're exactly right. From what I can tell, users seem to be continually willing to give information to Google and Facebook and other providers in order to get the services that they want. And that's a perfectly rational decision. Obviously, privacy groups may feel like that's not a rational decision, but the consumers seem to think it is. And you're right that this may be a perception created by the media that people are upset, when in fact people aren't upset, as shown by how they vote their feet. There have been massive defections off Facebook, as far as I can tell, and there weren't massive defections off of any of the other platforms when either breaches were discovered or quote unquote bad behavior. So you're right to raise that concern. I was sort of trying to allude to that, but it's there's at least a perception of that, and so who knows how that plays out. But it's not like Tom is going to say something there.
Well, yeah, certainly the situation with respect to Facebook stock coming back when investors within the last few weeks decided that the customers were not leaving the platform in large numbers, that's the implication. The customers are not running away. Now, a lot of what happened in this particular situation, and there's some trepidation, maybe calling it a breach or not calling it a breach, is that the cost to the individual users of the violations, apparently, of Facebook's own rules and the agreements they had with customers,
the costs are, don't seem to be there. I mean, Zuckerberg, when he testifies in Congress, is asked, was your data, was your personal data in the batch? Were you amongst the 50 million or so? And he said, yes, I was in there. But, you know, of course, they had to ask him. It wasn't clear what harm he had suffered being in the group. Now, it's creepy, and people, I don't think, like that level of, you know, somebody's got my data and they might do something with it. But if it jumps, you know, if he, and it's close to the line, certainly, in a way that people don't like, but if it jumps and people start, you know, suffering humiliation or some kind of problem because of their data's out there and they, you know, they have a really bad day as a result of that that data breach, as when, say, a Social Security number, a password goes out and you get identity theft or whatnot, yeah, then that's going to be, I think, a whole different order of reaction. But just at the creepy level, I think your comment is well taken, that people haven't really responded aggressively as customers, and they have not abandoned the platform.
This is Megan. I'll just jump in here. And I think I take the point. I think we also have to, though, look at the fact that Facebook has invested, we don't know how much money, in yet again revamping its privacy settings, and has also gone on a media blitz to explain to users and apologize to users. So that suggests to me that they've done some kind of assessment and believe that they will suffer in the market if they don't fail to take some steps. I also think it's important to recognize that there are some who believe that failing or not being on the platform, Facebook or other social media, perceive that they will be not participants in the economy. Now, personally, I'm not on Facebook. I haven't been on it in a decade. But I think there are, for many, Tom can probably articulate this far better than I, they need Facebook in order to do things in their lives and contribute to the economy. So I think whether, you know, that's also, those are all two other points to keep in mind.
Well, they're important. I agree completely.
Well, I think that's a good place to end. So before I hand it over to Devin, I just want to thank Tom, Jamil, and Megan for a good conversation. Obviously, this issue will go on, and I could imagine us regrouping as events dictate, but I think a good place to stop for today. So, Devin, if you want to close this out.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Matthew. And I want to say, to dovetail off of your final comments there, Matthew, that this conversation will continue. And as I mentioned earlier in our program, it will continue next week, Tuesday, June 12th, with the initial release of a short paper on to start our privacy series for this group. So I hope that folks are paying attention, and we'll keep up with the progress of that when we get started. I also, on behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, want to thank Megan, Tom, Jamil, and Matthew for joining us, and also our audience. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for joining the Free Lunch Podcast today. Bye-bye, everyone.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.